So the next step in the Anapanasati Sutta is viraka, viraka anupasi, investigating dispassion. I breathe in, investigating dispassion. I breathe out. When Ajahn Buddhadasa uses that term, has it translated as fading away, fading away, a sense of say diminishing of the kind of strength of sort of emotion that is afflicted by defilement, which is basically what say the sense of dispassion as well, but using that sense of fading away, because so much of our suffering is the latching on to an idea, a feeling, an object of attention, a particular view and opinion, and grab it with this passion. And using passion in a sense of a more general sense, a sense of deep belief in what it is representing. And the so that we swim in the opposite direction of the Dhamma by getting hooked in with this passionate belief in a sense of self, a particular fear, a particular object of desire, a particular view or opinion, a particular aversion, and it perpetuates the whole cycle of suffering. And that's always what Anapanasati is about, or any practice in Buddhism is always about cutting through suffering, bringing suffering to a point of cessation, seeing through the self-inflicted problems that we create for ourselves. And it's it arises out of that passion for things. So it's not just generally the passion is usually, we associate that with sensuality. But from the Buddhist perspective, it's much, much, much broader and deeper. So to be attentive to as we breathe in, what's the particular passion of the moment? And particularly, say, riding on the the say coming after the anicca, impermanence. This is a natural result of when we really take impermanence into the heart and see the inherent changing nature of things, the inherent uncertainty of things, then one of the natural results would tend to be an attenuating of passion, a dispassion within the heart, and that fading away of the strength of our of the tenacity of the mind that is proliferating around that which creates suffering. So to allow that to arise, one, and then also to actually check and see, you know, is the reflections on impermanence actually working? Am I taking this to heart? Am I actually getting a handle on this fundamental teaching of anicca? And if dispassion is not the result, then it's an indication of the sort of missing a shot. We have that opportunity, so to be able to allow that to arise, give the space for that quality of dispassion to arise within the heart. Otherwise, we miss the opportunity that the Buddha is giving us to taste the results of his teaching. So this quality of dispassion, and then also to direct attention to that consciously. So one is recognizing it as a natural result of the seeing impermanence, being very present for the breath, but then also there's the opportunity as well to direct attention to dispassion, to bring it up I think the first thing is to bring it up as a desirable element to be incorporating within the heart, because it's that quality of dispassion that leads to a sense of cooling and quality of settledness. It's always being swept up by the particular mood of the moment that unsettles the mind and keeps the mind agitated and creates a veil over the mind, so that we're not really being able to see things as they truly are. We're seeing things through the light of our particular bias that we have passion for. Whether it's the bias of liking and wanting, or the bias of disliking and not wanting, or just the bias of confusion and delusion, it creates a veil that we're unable to see clearly with. So directing attention to dispassion gives us the opportunity to drop that veil, to sort of stop the tendency to tint everything we see and experience with the color that we're seeing through at that time. This quality of dispassion is very, very important from the Buddha's perspective. we see through that, we're constantly seeing with the tint of our biases. Part of it is the kind of the stories that go on in our minds, that we don't have dispassion for. We keep repeating the same old storyline. That is the kind of the basis of our self view and world view. The storyline of you know, whatever. I mean, me, the hopeless case, or me, the fortunate one, or me, the having had such and such an experience, this is who I am now. We repeat these stories or things, you know, you see in our own minds when we sit in meditation. Some of the stories just keep on going. I've been meditating for 30 years. There's stories that I continue to repeat to myself. And it's so pathetic. it's just so pathetic. It's so worthy of dispassion. But you know, the story is there's some morbid fascination with a particular story that gets repeated. You know, and we're loath to put down the story. And Ajahn Yamaro gives that wonderful example of that he had when he was at Amaravati. And a person who, from New York, American anyway, I think he was from New York, who was requested to come to stay at Amaravati. I think this was in the late 80s, something like that. And he had been diagnosed with AIDS. And in those days, there was no really effective treatment, so that basically, sort of facing a death sentence, and sort of imminent death, and feeling that, you know, what he really wanted to do was spend as much as his energy and health allowed to be in a spiritual community and practice the Dhamma. And he told the situation and also that as of yet the symptoms are not extreme, and asked to come to live in the community, so that he was accepted. And was living and practicing. And would go into the city from time to time for medical checkups and just to keep track of what was happening with his body, his physical condition. And then one day he had gone into the city, and then he'd come back, and he was sitting in the hall, just looked totally glum and despondent. Ajahn Amaro walked into the hall and saw him there, and immediately came up and asked him, "What's wrong? How are you doing?" And sort of give him the opportunity to speak and share whatever sort of disastrous thing had happened that day. And he started relating to Ajahn Amaro that they'd been doing a series of tests over these previous weeks or months, and the results came in today, and actually he didn't have AIDS at all. He had a very, very rare blood disorder that had somewhat similar symptoms, but was actually treatable. And so he's telling this story with giving the account of this. And Ajahn Amaro said, "Wow, isn't that good news?" And the guy said, "Yeah, I guess so, but I lost my story." that is the investment, the passion for the particular story, and even if it's, you know, one of disaster and imminent death, and it's a great story, and it created an identity, and now he was just somebody else. And you think of ourselves, what stories do we live by? What stories do we create for ourselves? What stories do we have passion for? And without even noticing it, because we weave them into the fabric of our who we perceive ourselves to be and what we think we are. And to be able to step back and look on things with dispassion and say, "This is a thought. It arises, it ceases. This is a feeling. It arises, it ceases. This is a particular view. It arises and ceases. This is the body. It arises and ceases." So that to direct attention to dispassion, to give oneself the opportunity to have a break from the whole realm of what we find life fraught with. 'Cause in the end, it's just this all, it's just this endless sort of suffering that we create. So to look on the experience of within our minds, within ourselves, through the lens of dispassion, and really to attend to the, as we breathe in, what's the feeling? What's the perception? As we breathe in, can we hold that with dispassion? Investigating dispassion, I breathe in. Investigating dispassion, I breathe out. To allow that dispassion to encompass the particular feeling, perception, thought, idea, mood, to imbue that with dispassion, with fading away. To allow that just as, in the same way that I say, as the breath comes in, and as we get to the end of the breath, and there's sort of a fading away of the in breath, just as natural. And then as we breathe out, there's this, the energy towards it, and then it fades away. It can't go on forever. In the same way, there's just allowing that fading away of the thoughts and feelings and the mind that is creating the perceptions and views, so that it's giving the opportunity to the heart to establish itself in this quality of dispassion. And dispassion is not let's say a sense of just cold sterility. It's freeing, it's liberating to not be crippled by the particular biases and whole clingings on that we tend to experience. These biases, the Buddha talked about the biases of the mind. Chandakati, dosakati, mohakati, bhayakati, akati are biases. Ways that the mind leans, it leans through the, it's, and is being leaned on by these particular modes. biased by fear, biased by aversion, biased by delusion, biased by fear. These ways that the biases of the mind that establish themselves, and to allow that to fade away, and to recognize that is a particular bias. The mind is being tainted, is being tinted by that particular bias, and to allow that to fade. And there are certain things that we can be doing that are proactive in terms of dispassion. One of the classic modes of fostering dispassion, of course, are reflection on the body and seeing the impermanence and constructed nature of the body, and the way that it is. In order to sort of temper the perception. Normally we would relate to the body in a way of either trying to as an object of desire, an object of let's say sexuality, either viewing other people's bodies from that perspective, or the viewing one's own as a mode, a vehicle for sensual and sexual gratification, but also just the modes of health and vigor and being something, being somebody in a body who is somebody. We create a whole realm of our perceptions of personality and self-view through the vehicle of the body. And just to step back and sort of say, well, what is the body? Because when you assume that, you begin with that assumption, And it permeates everything else, and how we live our life, and how we various choices we make, obsessions and fears, or whatever that we get caught up in. Because even just the sense of what the body is, say, we tend to we begin with a certain perceptual bias already, which maybe we're not even aware of. It's like you say the perception of food. Well, what is food? And normally when we think of food, then we think of something sort of, you know, nicely laid out on the table and nicely presented, and something that has particular flavors and has particular fragrances and you know, looks pleasing and delicious. But I mean, food, in order for food to be something that is actually useful, I mean, it's not actually, that's actually, sort of, I mean, it's just sort of the raw material for food. I mean, for something to be food, then you've got to get it into your mouth and sort of chew it and masticate it. But that's still sort of not even food that is that has much benefit to us, and we have to swallow it from there. And it gets sort of mixed with kind of bile and digestive juices. And that's, then it has some, brings benefit to us. I mean, food is something, food that, when we think of food, it's sort of something that nourishes us and supports us, that we eat, we live. I mean, we live because we can have food. But, you know, it isn't until it's gone through a whole process of, you know, being mixed with saliva and bile and chewed and sort of swallowed, that it turns into something that's useful. So that the perception, the reality, is something different than the perception. And the body is quite similar. And, you know, our bodies are certainly useful to us because of, not because of the sort of the, its covering of skin and its particular shape and form, but through all the sort of internal muscles and tendons and internal organs that work and pump blood around. The whole thing is what creates a body that is, we can rely on and use and live our life with. So that reflecting on, like the saying, 32 parts of the body, taking that as a meditation, that is particularly helpful for creating and fostering dispassion. That, again, rather than the observation of the body through the say the eye of desire, the eye of passion, and it's a looking at it from a different perspective, and using those 32 parts of the body, hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. I mean, those are the external elements. which we can see, which when we start to even separate those out, they're already turned to something. You should start separating them out, and none of them start to look particularly desirable or worthy of passion. It's interesting. Sort of things also interesting how things change in the sense of as a increasingly senior monk. Well, in Thailand, as I'm going to Thailand these days, because I've been ordained for so long, and people know me, respect me. Then people are starting to ask for my hair and my nails. And sort of they want to save them. It's sort of absurd. How do you say? Passion can be created for anything, really. But in general, that's normally not the case. And certainly, as we look at a clump of hair, that doesn't arouse desire. It tends to cool the mind. And then, as you review through yourself, and then going internally, underneath the skin and starting to investigate inside, just visualizing. Just like that hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, and skin. Flesh, sinews, bones, bone marrow. Those are the structural elements of the body. And they're, you realize that they have a sort of individual characteristics of sinews and muscles and bones and whatnot. I mean, the tendency in looking at say either one's own body or bodies of others, and there's this individuality that is almost immediately imputed. But when one looks at muscle, bones, it takes one away from that individuality. Internal organs of sort of the intestines and liver and kidneys, heart, lungs. One doesn't even consider sort of individuality when one looks in that way. They're just, these are organs. And everybody has their internal organs, but as long as they stay internal, then they're sort of bearable. You don't have to view them or see them. Brian was telling me a story of a patient that, because of his illness and fluids that were building up in the abdominal cavity over time, that they had to actually make an abdominal incision and then have all the the intestines actually outside, and in order for the body not to be too stressed and create pressure that would shut the whole digestive system down. And then, of course, when the relatives come, then you've got to sort of get them sort of neat and tidy somehow. Cover them with, and well, they had to be sort of. I mean, they weren't just sort of strewn around the table, right? But they all had to be sterile, and so it was encapsulated. And then tape so that it was, but still, it's when relatives come, it's definitely covering it up. It's come to see old Uncle Joe and see his intestines sort of spewing out around and about him. It definitely shifts perception. And one of the things that's always I've always found striking, and like seeing autopsies, is that the layer of fat that is underneath the skin. There, it's just is a, and I find it curious, and there, I've seen several autopsies, and I always find it striking, in a dispassionate way, that the body having its sort of layer of fat, and even on a rather slim person, still there's this layer of fat that's sort of this yellowish stuff that is sort of underneath the skin. And that, each of us, as we, when we start to reflect on the body in those different ways, it's just different things that are striking, that tend to create dispassion. One of the, even in, say, contemplating skin, which is, normally considered the, it's sort of the external part of the body that you see, and is all the focus of attention is normally on that let's say the skin or what one can see. But just even something like knuckles. It's just the way the skin is around knuckles. It's hard for it to arouse much sort of fascination or passion. That one can direct attention, even in something that might arouse passion, directing attention to different aspects that are cooling, that are, take the mind away from its perception that arouses interest and passion. So we're doing that with this, like with this contemplation of 32 parts of the body. Hair of the head, hair of the body, nails, teeth, skin, sinews, flesh, bone marrow, various internal organs, fluids of the body, blood, sweat, fat, tears. And all the these different elements that are one we don't even think about. And as soon as you do think about it, do bring attention to it, then it gives one the opportunity to step back, step out of the habit, the bias that tends to this passion. And what it does help do is a sense of, say, dispassion fading away, allowing that attention to fade from its tendency to desire, attachment, belief in that which is either, you know, is supporting greed, hatred, and delusion in one way or another. And so that giving ourselves the opportunity to experience dispassion, cooling. Because when that quality of cooling within the heart appears, then there's the possibility of peacefulness, and that's what we're practicing for. You know, we want to be peaceful, but we keep getting caught up in the things that feed the greed, hatred, and delusion, feed the passions of belief and bias. And so you know, it's only we ourselves that can take responsibility for the practice. And it's the Buddha says that over and over again. This is something that you know, all he can do is point the way, and it's up to each individual to do the practice themselves. And so the pointers are pointing in the direction of dispassion, of cooling, of seeing clearly the implications of impermanence, unsatisfactoriness, non-self. And really embracing that, allowing that to keep placing that foremost in the heart, rather than sort of from time to time bringing it up and then sort of merrily continuing to get absorbed and caught by the things that keep us suffering, keep us agitated. So I offer that for reflection this morning.